Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat Cold Tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening.
What? I'm not sure, but I can tell that you're very focused, grounded, and yet ephemeral all at the same time.
Ephemeral. It's my favorite artery out of all of them.
That was a legitimate pun right there. You score points for that one, man.
I kind of lost points. I think puns are sort of like...
The lowest form of humor that people laugh at.
Some would say sarcasm. Some named Mr. Wilde would say it's the lowest form of humor. The lowest form of wit, but the highest form of intelligence.
I would buy that. I don't know if that was our show opening, in which case that would be the first time that I've never said, you're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey, but that might be a better show opener, so we'll figure that one out.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com.
In case you haven't noticed, if you're watching on YouTube, you might have figured this out. I have a guy sitting next to me here who is pretty well known, at least if you're on the internet, whose name is JP Sears. So he's here at Bulletproof Labs at my house. We've been having him do all sorts of cryotherapy and other crazy biohacking stuff here. And I'm actually going to interview him today about some kind of cool stuff that you might not know about JP Sears. And he might actually answer at least one question without a human response, but I'm not sure.
It's a might with a capital M. So I'm looking forward to getting into things that I don't know about me.
Well, here's something about the cool fact of the day, which is something that I've had in every show. And it's that, according to this guy, Oscar Wilde, sarcasm is the lowest form of wit, but the highest form of intelligence. But you stole my cool fact of the day. Did you say you did that?
You're welcome. Is there anything else I can do to steal your thunder?
I'm sure that you'll find something, JP. But that's all right. You know, my thunder was really just like a drizzle today.
I feel like your self-esteem is getting lower.
I've been wanting to upgrade my self-esteem. Is that possible?
Yeah, just mold-free coffee is the best self-esteem upgrade possible. But I will say this. You're ridiculous in the best way possible. I love it.
Thank you, sir.
But you mentioned Oscar Wilde, and he has another thought that I absolutely love. He suggests that life is too important to take seriously. And one of the reasons why I absolutely love hanging around you, and I tell this to everybody I know when I'm talking about you behind your back, but saying good things behind your back, is you are like a giant child with a very intelligent brain. But I think one of the reasons why you have such a magnetic charisma around you is you exude playfulness. And to me, you embody the idea life is too important to take seriously, which is ironic. You do very serious stuff. You change the world, you change lives, and you do it with a playful mindset. And that's something that's incredibly inspiring to me.
Wow, that's like a massive compliment. Thanks, man.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that. See, I keep going into this like cool fact of the day stuff, and we just keep talking about like all this other stuff, like me. No, I'm kidding.
Fact of the day, Dave Asprey is cool.
You're rubbing off on me. I'm becoming more egotistical just sitting around you, JP.
You are, but I'm a little more humble than you. I'm the most humble person I know.
So if you guys don't know JP Sears' work, you've got to check out his YouTube channel. He's done basically, I don't know what to call them, roasts is maybe an appropriate thing. It's just hilarious things about paleo, about biohacking, about vegan diets, about pretty much any sacred cow or sacred vegan cow that you can find. He is slaughtered in the most like self-deprecating, hilarious way possible. So I hope you must have like a YouTube URL or something. Like, where do you send people to find your stuff? Because if you haven't seen at least some of his stuff, you probably have seen it. You don't know you've seen it, but where do people go for this? Because it's awesome.
Awaken with JP. So that's where you can check out all my stuff on YouTube and Facebook. And of course, if you find me incredibly offensive, then those are the places where you want to avoid going.
Well, let's talk about sarcasm for a minute here. There's actually real research on sarcasm. And the research says something that it improves creativity and cognitive function. And this is neuroscience kind of level of stuff. So basically, thinking of it does one thing and delivering it does another thing. But on the flip side, the stuff that I teach, especially at the 40 Years of Zen, when we're looking at these advanced like ego awareness sort of things, pretty much whenever you're using sarcasm, there's an element of anger that's behind it.
Yeah.
Like you wanted to say something. So the idea of, you know, of act with kindness and things like that. I've actually, I have a very sarcastic wit. People listening probably wouldn't believe that. But
I'm sure they wouldn't.
No, I actually like toned it way down because I realized even if I was meaning to be humorous, sometimes I was hurting people's feelings. And I'm like I want to progress through the world like with, you know, be kind to others as sort of a primary thing to do. But then like it is kind of fun to like be a little bit unkind to someone just because they needed it.
Yeah.
And so your form of sarcasm is usually though not like you'll make fun of something that I would say needs attention on it, but you end up redirecting it back to yourself at the end of the day. So you're sort of the butt of the joke at the end of the day versus the person whose belief system you're insulting, slaying, and otherwise poking holes in.
Yeah.
Is that on purpose?
Yeah, to me it is. I think sarcasm, and I hadn't heard that research, but I totally vibe with it. I do think at the root of all sarcasm, I mean, listen to the word sarcasm, scarcasm. I think it really does have its roots in pain. And I know my humor, it comes from my pain. When I was a child, the way I sort of survived psychologically is I learned to make people laugh. So the idea of if I can make someone laugh, I feel like I matter to them. So that helped me like cover up my sense of insignificance inside with a temporary like 4 or 5 minute bout of significance coming from the outside. So my sarcasm became a way of covering up my pain. So when it comes to expressing humor with sarcasm or satirism, which I think comes from Saturn.
No, I think that comes from those half goat, half horse, like half, isn't a satyr?
You've
like
offended all the vegans out there already.
It's a dish. It's like half goat, half tofu, and you mix it all up.
That sounds disgusting. But nonetheless, when one expresses their humor, like, yes, I do believe there's pain in it. So are we projecting that pain onto someone else and hurting them? Mm-hmm. Or are we essentially owning our pain? And therefore, I think shining a light to help other people get in touch with their pain rather than having the humor inflict pain on them. And that's why I think self-deprecating humor, I think with a compassionate consciousness towards self rather than using self-deprecating humor to shame self and just hurt our pain even more, I think that's important to be aware of so that humor doesn't become a way of just hurting other people, which to me, it absolutely can. Humor is a powerful energy, powerful psychological energy. Mm-hmm. Light side is, I think it can be like an alchemist of healing and self-awareness. And shadow side is, I think it can be a knife that cuts into people.
Well, I mean, there's the sort of dick joke comedians with, you know, 3-hour podcasts where it's mostly just kind of just chewing on stuff.
Yeah.
Where sometimes it's funny, but it's like you kind of feel a little dirty when you're done listening to it. And there's another side of it where you're like, okay, like it was damned funny, but I feel uplifted by that instead of like angry.
Yeah, for sure. And I think listening, if I can like use a big word, listening, that was tough. Listening to our biofeedback, like how do you respond to humor that you're using or someone's using around you? If you hurt, like our feelings don't lie.
Yeah.
I think Carl Jung said it best, our feelings are the language of our soul. I think they come from a very deep place of truth inside of us. So if we feel worse and heavy and like fatigued from a conversation or listening to people joke, it's like, wow, that was probably hurtful humor. And we can be amused, we can be laughing, but laughing is a form of weeping. It can be us like emoting pain because we're experiencing pain being inflicted on us with humor. But to me, the light side of humor, it's one of my favorite. I would honestly call it a psychological biohack. I really would. I think when we can laugh not at ourselves, but with ourselves and with other people, you get the whole shot of endorphins. It's an uplifting experience. And I think also another angle that humor is a powerful biohack is it helps us not take ourselves so seriously. I'm a big fan of have beliefs, but don't believe your beliefs. And I think when we can use humor as the force of detachment, so we can have our beliefs, but not be so attached and just believe our beliefs. To me, that's one of my favorite kind of like psychological brain biohacks.
So you're saying humor can make people maybe less tribal?
Absolutely.
And at the same time, if it's applied wrong, if you're only making fun of the other side and not of yourself, then it actually increases tribalism, right?
For sure. And actually, just so I'm clear, what do you mean by tribalism?
Well, the way I see tribalism, it's always like an us versus them thing. So like, okay, I'm bulletproof and McDonald's, they're bad people. And you sort of like build walls between people. But end of the day, what those walls do is they make you stop thinking about what you're doing, about what they're doing, and make it about good versus evil, which is just a straight up way to stop thinking and use your emotions, very old, like primitive emotions, instead of actually using a rational brain and just realizing, oh, maybe we just disagree about like what to put on our goddamn plate for. Like, does it really matter?
Yeah, you know, I don't know who it is, like the Zen people. That'll make me sound intelligent if I say this is a Zen quote. The Buddha said this too. And like whoever else is dead, whose attorneys aren't going to sue me for like misrepresenting them. So the Buddha said this, and like whoever else, Abraham Lincoln probably. They suggest that the source of all disease is a sense of separation. And I know that really oversimplifies things, yet I think it's also a very helpful consideration. So if we're increasing tribalism, us versus them, that's separation. And to me, part of the beauty of humor, the light side of humor, is it's a form of communication, communion. Mm-hmm. So it decreases tribalism, increases our sense of connection. So if all disease is created by a sense of separation, then maybe health and healing and an increased quality of life comes through more connection with thyself and connection with our community.
Well, you've definitely cracked the code, because a lot of people, in fact, I think most people who've seen your work have no idea that you're a holistic coach, advanced practitioner. Like you've actually done a lot of your own work on that front. Mm, yeah. And that translated into 100 million views on YouTube, which is like an insane number. I believe that I have 5 million, so I'm sort of feeling insignificant.
Who's the real man?
But it's when I have no idea what my numbers on YouTube are, but that seems like about right, whatever. But you've definitely done something different, because the virality of the stuff that you say, like when you put together a video like that, people just share it because you did something that wasn't maybe as hurtful as, you know, just a rant. And we certainly see like hurtful rants shared sometimes, yeah. But it's a different energy to it. And I think it does get shared more. And I don't know if you or anyone else has ever done quantitative analysis on that, but there's something, a different vibe in what you do that I haven't really seen from other comedians. And that was why I wanted to have you on the show. Plus we just got to be friends when you started making fun of biohacking. And I was like, you have to be on.
I love to make fun of what's important to me. Yeah, and I think part of, you know, when someone's on social media and they click share, and I've been very blessed by whoever's up there blessing people. I think it's Santa Claus still.
He's one of them.
Yeah, he's my favorite Saint Nick. So when someone clicks share on social media, I think at a deep level what it means is they've just seen something about themselves that they weren't aware of. Mm. And something that's very important to me in the work that I do, including the comedy work that I do, is facilitating increased self-awareness. I think the purpose of our lives is to live our life. And I think a lot of us walk around and we are just a stranger to ourselves. We don't know who we are, but we sit here and we think we know who we are. And then we become convinced that we are who we think we are. But I think who we are, like the true being inside Dave, the true being inside JP, we're far more expansive than what we can comprehend. So one of the reasons why I love facilitating increased self-awareness, even if it's just like a little reflection of self-awareness, like you watch a comedy video, you see something about yourself that you didn't know was there, and you like it, you resonate with it, so you hit share. To me, that self-awareness helps us step deeper into to truly living the miracle of who we are, rather than treating ourselves like a stranger while we're just trying to be who we're expected to be, who we think we're supposed to be. I think life is too short to be someone other than ourselves.
When you decide to share something on social media that's not, you know, your own work, what thought process goes through your mind before you decide whether you're going to share something or not?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a couple of things. One, did I receive benefit from this? If I receive benefit from it, like that's a great green check mark. Green means go. And I think the other thing is, like, is this a message that's kind of congruent with my brand? So my brand, comedy as well as just sincerity are two components of my brand. I think the comedy is more well-known. So if it's a congruent message, awesome. But just because something's like a great message and I receive benefit doesn't necessarily mean like I'm going to share it. Like someone might have like these amazing orthotics for your shoes. I'm like, wow, that's a beneficial message. But I'm probably not going to share that.
Orthotics aren't funny. Is that the deal?
Not yet. As far as I know.
I think you can break through that glass ceiling for orthotics.
I can make orthotics funny that I'm really making. But I'd be curious, if I'm allowed to turn that question back on you, what makes you share something on social media that's not your own content?
I have a kind of a religious thing, and I'm always working to share this with the staff at Bulletproof and just with the team who support our mission. And it's just this simple question: what's in it for you? And I don't mean for you, our staff. I mean, what's in it for you, the audience? Yeah. So my filter is like, I read the thing, and then is it worth the time that I'm asking someone to invest by looking at it? Yeah. Like, will it add more than it takes away? And I did a math equation a while back, and it was a really hard one. It had like algebra and stuff in it. And it was, what's the dwell time on the website when people read Bulletproof content? And then what's the around 50 million downloads on Bulletproof Radio? 50 million hours divided by the number of waking hours is hundreds of human lifetimes.
Wow.
That's so, and you, by the way, are at a bigger number than I am. right? With 100 million YouTube things. I don't know if you look at your average listen time, but that means that if we're not adding value with what we do, we're actually mass murderers.
Wow.
And
I like that.
I believe that's
gruesome, but that's a powerful way of looking at it.
And that is how I view it. So I'm not going to share something if it takes away more than it gives.
Yeah.
Right. And whether it's my share, like something I wrote, or whether it's something that someone else did. So I see all sorts of shit on Facebook and I'm like, no, I'm not going to share that. Even if it might be mirthful or a little funny or whatever.
Yeah.
So that the people who come and follow me on Facebook or on Instagram or wherever, that they're like, okay, this was valuable, and then they become engaged. And the engagement levels for Bulletproof people are like the comments and likes and things like that are very high as a ratio because they're real followers versus like bots or something.
Yeah.
And it's that just constant, what's in it for you, not what's in it for me. And a lot of times I think that the unconscious sharing, we just kind of throw stuff up on Facebook. You're like, what's in it for me? Like, what's this going to make me look like?
Yeah.
And for me, it's like, will this serve you? Because if this serves you best, it's actually going to make me look good anyway. But for sure. I honestly don't really care if it makes me look good. I get these people who are like this offended me. Therefore, I'm going to unfollow. And the response, and I'd offer this to anyone who doesn't like this show, same thing. The unfollow button is right here, and I draw a little arrow. I'm like, it's okay. Like, if this isn't serving you, I want you to stop listening.
Yeah, go live your life. Don't detract totally. From your life just to mindlessly listen to that.
Yeah, and don't hold me hostage by unliking me. Trust me. I won't notice. Like,
well, that's so true. And I love your, I mean, that's a very caring view. Are you going to just rob minutes, hours from people's life? If so, like, wow, that's taking life. That's murdering. Like, that gets
your attention. Internet marketing.
Or am I adding to it? For sure. You know, there's some Facebook pages that I personally used to follow, used to being the key word. And these become the pages where, you know, they're just doing the constant, like, every single hour we're going to post something. Mm-hmm. They're playing that game. Nothing wrong with that, but what they're posting, is it adding or is it subtracting? And unfortunately, not all, but some of them like detract. So I'm really quick with the unfollow button.
Yep. I am too. It's like, show me less posts like this. I've managed to get most politics out of my feed.
Mm.
And what pisses me off now is
politics,
like,
is that a thing now? I haven't noticed.
It's like a religion, but different.
Okay.
Because people fight wars over both of them. But I think the order of operations is different. I don't really know.
But I think with politics, they worship like more people than just the one guy or gal.
Yeah.
Guy.
And neither one of them has anything to do with money.
I would nothing. It's just caring about human nature is at the heart of both of them.
This just turned dark, didn't it?
It did. Dave, why do I have so many unfollows on my channel right now?
No, it's really kind of funny because I posted something about the FDA recently. Mm-hmm. And it was basically one of Trump's picks for the FDA is actually a board member of one of the most aggressive anti-aging research institutes out there. I'm like, this is the coolest thing ever, because if we get like a libertarian anti-aging radical dude running the FDA, maybe we'll be allowed to have access to therapies that they're already doing in China and Japan that are not even like on the radar here. And immediately, people are like, oh, welcome to the Trump train. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, guys. The fact that I like some things a president does and I don't like some things a president does, it doesn't mean that I support the office. It doesn't mean I support a specific candidate or a specific president. I only care about what they do.
Yeah.
And I've actually never found a politician who does anything close to what they promise to do. They all do the opposite or whatever's in their best interest. Once they've bought your vote by lying to you, how's that for dark? They're going to do whatever they're going to do. And so once I say something either pro or con, then the tribalism and those religious behaviors come in. And here's the deal for people listening, like, Dave, are you're lefty or you're libertarian? I'm like, actually, here's the deal. You cannot take the probably 10,000 different facets of things that you believe would make the best system and conveniently separate them into two buckets and say, this is my bucket. That's anti-thinking. Wow. So here's the deal. Like, think for yourself. And yes, there are times when I absolutely support a decision and there are other times where I absolutely don't.
For sure.
And so to try and simplify things into like there's only two sides, Oh, for God's sake. Like, that's so boring.
That'd be like, to me, that'd be like saying your body only has two cells. It's like, well, I think we're a little more complex than that. And that's part of what adds the three dimensionality to life and the psychological experience of our social environment, politics being part of it. And I'm routinely fascinated with politics and religion. And I'm going to say present company included with what I'm about to say, just so you don't get too offended at me. Get offended. Now you're offended that I'm trying not to offend you. JP, you don't think I can handle it?
You've insulted everyone now, including yourself.
I hate myself right now, Dave. We have a biohack for that.
We do.
So I am absolutely fascinated by the emotional nature of humankind and how our emotions can completely override our prefrontal cortex. So we can have a very intelligent person in a discussion, and the name Trump is brought up, like you just said, and all of a sudden the prefrontal cortex is completely shut down, and there's just this emotional reactivity. There's no logical, rational thought happening. It's just an emotional outpouring, which is fine. I think we need to feel our emotions. I think if you try to suppress them, it progressively kills us. But when we don't know we're in a state of reactivity and we're trying to like solve our emotional reactive issues in a logical discussion about politics, like I think most discussions about politics aren't about politics. They're two very wounded inner children inside just getting angry because they're really afraid inside.
That matches my reality. In fact, in Headstrong, and yes, I do see that. I just conveniently worked a plug for my new book in there because the reason I brought up Headstrong is exactly because it's relevant to what you're saying here. There's these three behaviors that I wrote about in the Bulletproof Diet. I call them the Labrador brain, but in Headstrong, it actually goes deeper than that. And the three behaviors are what every life form has to do. And it works for mammals, but it turns out it also works for bacteria, and your mitochondria are bacteria. And these are three things you'd be very, very familiar with and comfortable with. The Labrador brain, it requires you to eat everything so you don't starve to death, because then the species can't reproduce. Okay? And then the one that we're talking about right here, which is run away from or kill everything that might be a threat.
Wow.
Right? And so this is why dogs bark at random crap. Like it's just an inborn behavior. And this is the algorithm for anything to stay alive, including a plant. They can't run away from, so they grow spines to kill you, or they grow poisons to kill you so you won't eat them, right? Because otherwise the species can't reproduce. And the final thing involved in reproducing the species is the Labrador goes, oh, look, a leg, I'll go hump it. So there's the actual act of reproduction. And so I'm just trying to figure out, is there anything in your life you've ever done that you're ashamed of that didn't come from one of those three behaviors?
That's a great question. I would guess it'd probably be hard to find something outside of those behaviors.
Right. Yeah. And all of the emotions we're talking about in political discourse, in religious disagreements, you know, even pro sporting, like, that's not my team, you know, and just those deep emotions, those emotions come from the lowest level bacteria that are running our bodies, which are mitochondria.
Welcome to the club of thinking like a low-level bacteria. So what that means to me, like to me, that sounds like all like self-preservation. Like if you are different than me, psychologically, something's different than me. Yeah. I see it as a threat, so I want to kill it. You know, fight it or flight it. And to me, like that, that's a very self-preservation mentality. But I think self-preservation's geared around creating more quantity of life, live longer, don't die. But to me, self-realization is what gives us quality of life. And I think self-realization isn't about kill what's different from me. I think self-realization is understand what's different from me because I get to expand. Mm-hmm. Like I don't like hanging out with only like-minded people. I don't grow. I don't get challenged. I love hanging out with like-hearted people, but preferably like-hearted people. So there's a acceptance-based relationship. Like it's a safe space. But like-hearted people who are also, at least at times, different-minded, not just like-minded. Mm-hmm. I think when everybody agrees with each other, it's like, okay, I feel more sense of certainty. I feel safer, but I'm not growing. I'm not getting challenged.
Well, that sense of safety there, like from a mitochondrial nervous system ego perspective, like you know, okay, great. No, that's all safe. And if you look at what these bacteria did when they colonized our cells and essentially took over, they're like, oh, look, a mobile petri dish. That's the coolest thing ever. Well, let's just move right in and take over. And we'll decide when a cell dies, when a cell replicates, and we'll decide how much energy the cell gets. And like, that's what they're doing. So when you allow them to be in charge, and it's like letting the phone in your battery letting the battery in your phone determine what your phone's going to do. Like, that's the wrong way to do it. You should be in charge.
Yeah.
So they're like, okay, now I organized all these cells full of me, these little bacteria, which are in almost every cell in your body. So now you're basically a walking biofilm with lots of complex systems in it. And they're like, okay, you need to hook up with other biofilms like me for defense. Right, which is why you would surround yourself by like-minded people who are the same as you, because you basically formed a distributed biofilm now, and then you'll reproduce with some of those people, and there you go, now you've got a tribe,
yeah.
Right? And then if you see someone who's different, you're like, that's a threat, that's not a tribe, but those things are coming from the very lowest level emergent behaviors in a really complex system. And when you realize that, when you say a like-hearted person, my view on all this is that, okay, these scared little stupid bacteria, none of which has much intelligence, but when you put a quadrillion of them together and they keep doing these behaviors, civilization emerges, right? Yeah. It's kind of cool. The self-awareness component of that is that, okay, now I see that I have these behaviors, and rather than letting these behaviors happen, I'm going to either reprogram the behaviors so the mitochondria chill the hell out, which is what meditation does, or I'm going to take more control, which I'm going to use my willpower, my energy to rationally catch myself in the act of, you know, flipping the guy off in traffic and going, actually, like, I believe my own story that he cut me off because he thinks he's better than me. And I replaced it with he cut me off because his wife is pregnant in the back of the car and they're going to the hospital.
Yeah.
You don't know, right? So, like, make up a story that makes you happy, right?
For sure.
It doesn't matter. The story I usually make up is that he robbed a bank, but the bank had bad money in it, so he's getting away, and that's really good. No, I'm kidding. I don't make that up. But the bottom line is, it doesn't really matter. Like, it's all a story, and none of it has any bearing on reality. But the like-hearted thing you're saying, I think, is when you go beyond the survival emergent bacterial consciousness that we identify as our own behaviors, which they really aren't. Those are, like, low-level operating system things.
That we carry, but they're not us.
Yeah.
Yeah, to me, a biohack, and when I'm around you, I call everything a biohack. But to me, truly, it is a biohack. When there's something we disagree with, the biohack is seek to understand it.
Yeah.
Not disagree with what we disagree with, just creating more resistance, more division, but understand that which we disagree with. Not for the sake of coming to terms of making ourselves agree or disagree, but aiming for the space in between, which in my opinion is just understanding. And to me, that's tolerance. That's, oh, you're different than me. Let me understand you. And now we have peace between you and I at the micro level. And I think even like parts of our own ego, parts of our own personality disagree with each other at times. And I think if we can find that sense of like understanding and rather than just disagreement and self-conflict, man, the inner world becomes a little bit more of a graceful place to live in.
Well, the inner conflict is where most of us spend enormous amounts of energy.
No, we don't.
Perfect. The inner equation that I worked out, and I certainly had lots of voices in my head for a long time, is that the more voices in your head, the more energy it takes to create the voices and then to manage the voices. Right? So it becomes overwhelming. And when you can resolve an inner conflict, it frees up the energy that was creating the conflict. And when I say frees up energy, I mean literally like electrons in your head for thinking or willing.
Sure.
But then also the amount of management of rational thinking about this conflict goes down. You're like, wow, like I feel freer, but what you actually feel is more energy, which equals freedom.
That. Yeah, I love that. And I think a lot of us, we don't give ourselves permission to actually be conflicted. Instead, we have conflict about our conflict. So this sort of like natural conflict, I think we inherently don't allow that to just be in the sense of like, oh, you know, I disagree with you, or these two parts of me disagree with each other, and that's okay. All of a sudden, you know, if we can do that, like that's okay kind of thing. our conflict creates a sense of peace and connection inside of ourselves. So it's a bit of a paradox, and I think it's a beautiful thing. Just like nutrition comes from compost, you know, the raw sewage creates something that gives you life.
Like tofu?
Like tofu, tofurkey, and I like the big game tofanimals, like tofiger, tofuna, tofelephants. I just love big game hunting. The tofu animals are also easier to kill, in my opinion, as well.
They don't run very fast.
No, they are very slow. But anyway, but I think when we have this mentality inside of ourselves and in our outer relationships that it's not okay to be conflicted, it's not okay to disagree, mm-hmm. we're conflicted about our conflict. And that's where we just really get hung up. But when we can say, oh, we disagree about this, and that's okay. I don't need to change your mind. You don't need to change mine. But maybe we can have understanding. And of course, there it is on the inner world as well. And man, how much, just like you said, how much more energy do we reclaim when we're not just fighting our conflict all the time? It's massive.
Well, there's another side to that too, which is that if I don't have an explanation for that, I'm not safe. And that's like the source of science trolls. Like there's no rational explanation for that happening, therefore it didn't happen. Like, sorry, show me a rational explanation for love, right?
Well, I don't know that love exists at this point.
Right. There's that point, you know, it doesn't exist. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that people will oftentimes reject they'll literally tell themselves something that clearly happened didn't happen. Because it would require a change in thinking, which creates a sense of lack of safety, which goes right back to those bacteria saying, you know, run away from things that are scary. If I was wrong about my beliefs about the way, you know, biology works or whatever else, therefore it's not going to work. So they come in essentially with guns blazing, like, you're an idiot. Here's a study that proves you're an idiot because it disagrees with what you said. That's all fear, like you were saying earlier. And the question is whether people are able to simultaneously say, this is the hypothesis that I'm going with right now, which is that things work this way. This may violate the hypothesis. It may not. It may be a bad data point. It may be a whole new exploration. Whatever of those it is, it's cool.
Yeah.
And if someone else thinks it's something different, let them do the research. But you see these crazy people out there like, let's ban research on this because it's already been proven not to work. And you're like, but actually, that's not how science works. You don't ban research on stuff that you think doesn't work because then you don't learn, like we just learned, oh, it turns out the immune system does connect to the brain. We just didn't see it because it was running next to a blood vessel all this time. Mm. So if we had banned research on that because we knew how it worked, like, holy crap. I kind of get stuck on that.
Yeah, and for me, that whole fear-based mentality, I think it becomes human nature or bacterial nature within the human to become addicted to the familiar and to fight things that threaten my construct of what is familiar. But to me, I mean, where our exhilaration is in life, it's not in the familiarity of our comfort zone of what's familiar. That's where we have this sense of safety. I don't even know if it's safe, but it's where we have a sense of safety. But man, the exhilaration is when we're in the mystery, when we're walking through the proverbial dark forest, when we're stepping off the cliff, and we don't know exactly what we're going to land in, when we're going to land, if we're going to land. And
you've been doing mushrooms again?
I'm doing the mushrooms that make me hallucinate that I'm not doing mushrooms. So at this point, I'm confused. So in my opinion, an ingredient for a great life is we have to be willing to scare ourselves to death in order to actually live. Not survive, but live. And I think when we're not willing to scare ourselves to death, what that means is I'm going to sit in this coffin of my comfort zone, stay with what's familiar. I'll repeat the same patterns of my relationships, same repetitive patterns of my health, same repetitive patterns of my thinking about who I am and what the world around me is. But if we can break out of that coffin and actually embrace the mystery, embrace the unknown, embrace what we fear the most. That's what I think it was last week. You posted this awesome video to Facebook, the people on the high dive.
Oh, that was so cool.
It was so amazing. You guys, you got to go check out this video on Dave's Facebook page. Scroll through it, you'll find it. But it was like a 15-minute long video, and I don't even think you have to watch the whole thing. But people on the edge of this...
It's like a 10-meter high dive.
Yeah, 10-meter high dive. And you watch these people struggle. Some of them just wouldn't jump. Others mm-hmm. were up there for a few minutes, and then they finally did. And man, is that a metaphoric representation of how we are relating to our comfort zone and resisting the mystery all the time. But if we can break through the membrane of our the coffin of our comfort zone into the mystery, man, the free fall, that's where life is at, in my opinion.
There's a struggle that was, the reason I like that video is you could see the struggle on their face and in their body movements, and the meat operating system, the mitochondria, they're like, do not jump, end of species. If you go down that far, we know as dumb little bacteria that you'll probably die. And the rational brain's like, I know I'm not going to die. But it's the struggle of the rational brain deciding to take ownership of the primitive in order to cause you to jump over. And when I watched this video, the reason I actually posted it was you see like these grown men who are like, I can't do it. And then you see this maybe, I'm guessing she was a 17-year-old girl. She looks at the edge and she looks down and you can tell it scares the shit out of her. And she takes like 3 steps back. She goes, all right, let's do this. Bam, she just jumps. And she was like, she had the most balls of anyone who went up there. And it was just so cool to see that. Right?
For sure. Yeah, that video is very inspiring. Mm-hmm. I think inspiring in two ways, like one, seeing a girl like that, and two, inspiring, like having the reflexive, just reactive seizing up in addiction to comfort. So it's inspiring to see that, be like, yep, I have that too. So mm-hmm. I want to recognize how that plays out in my life so I won't be a slave to that bacterial just master.
I've come to the point, and Headstrong is about how do you hack the bacteria so you have, or the mitochondria, which were bacteria, so that you have more energy every day, which lets you have more energy to manage them better. Yeah. And then how do you change the environment so that like you get a battery upgrade? But the end result of all this research is I just believe that our ego itself is an emergent phenomena of mitochondria. And that my career in tech has been managing complex systems and correlating events. And you don't mean to create like huge spikes in the internet when you just change one little bit here, but you make a quadrillion or a Googleplex of decisions using these tiny little rules, and you get these incredibly complex, beautiful patterns that no one would predict. Stephen Wolfram invented whole new fields of mathematics around information theory, information fields. And he's like, you want to understand how we make almost anything in nature? It's like, you take these tiny little rule sets, like dumb little rules, and just do them a kabillion times, to use a technical term, and you get a flower. And you get like almost everything you'd expect. So the most complex, beautiful things are not that complex. They're emergent from tiny rules. And I believe that a lot of our egoic behaviors, the ones that we're most ashamed of, are emergent from these tiny little things that are constantly sensing the environment and judging what's going to keep this petri dish alive the longest. Even though quite often what they're telling you to do is totally not in your best interest. And that the act of becoming self-aware is learning how to feel when that happens and then deciding whether to use the information from the feeling or whether to become the feeling and then act without conscious thought. And that, for me, has been a really big skill, and one I wouldn't really be very good at without having stuck computers to my head, like to have a lie detector to see when I'm lying to myself. Because, you know, my powers of self-deception are legion, and so everyone else.
Me too, for sure. And I love what you're saying. To me, that's like such a great way to articulate like an upgraded consciousness.
Yeah.
Like being conscious over the unconscious, reactive self-preservation mitochondria and bacteria inside of us. I think that's amazing.
Well, you, in your book, How to Be Ultra Spiritual, which is something that we're here to talk about, in addition to all the other stuff you're doing, which is just keeps making me laugh, you talk about vulnerability. When you're taking off your comedian hat, but I suppose when you're acting as a comedian too, you have, or we all have this idea of self-sabotage, like where you do things that get in your own way. So I want to know, what do you do to self-sabotage? And then what's your take as a holistic trained sort of coach about self-sabotage? Just walk me through your thinking about that.
Yeah, you know, sometimes the worst form of self-sabotage I do is not recognizing the self-sabotage that I'm acting out. So that's probably the worst thing I do.
So recursive self-sabotage, you're saying?
Recursive, as opposed to printing.
So you're saying self-sabotage of your own self-sabotage? Or blindness of self-sabotage?
Yeah, blindness of self-sabotage. Okay. So to me, it's kind of like the idea you can't get out of a prison that you don't know you're in. So if you're self-sabotaging...
Like Facebook.
Absolutely. But we know we're in Facebook. but I got to check Facebook real quick. Do you mind if we pause this for 20 or 30 minutes?
I should do the same thing, too. We'll just...
But aspects of my self-sabotage that are common, overworking. Mm-hmm. I find a lot of purpose, playfulness in my work, and there is a part of me that overworks for the sense of chasing a sense of value that isn't going to be found through work. So, I can really deplete myself burning the candle at both ends. And to me, self-sabotage is typically a symptom. So whether we're self-sabotaging psychologically, so it's like reoccurring patterns of depression, sadness, anger, disconnection, or we're acting out behaviors of self-sabotage, overworking, eating foods we shouldn't, hanging around people that don't serve us. To me, self-sabotage is always a symptom. And from my delusional perspective, it's a symptom of unresolved emotional pain and or disempowering beliefs of ourselves. So I think our self-sabotage, it's an expression that validates a disempowering belief of self or a pain of self.
That's pretty deep. And what? So for you, you're saying you basically burn yourself out when you're self-sabotaging.
Yeah.
Okay. For people listening, do you have a tool you recommend or some way for them to identify their self-sabotaging patterns, the ones they're not aware of?
Well, there's a line of a simple question that I love to ask people is, okay, what do you do? So recognize your self-sabotage. That's question number one. Question number two, which I think is so much more important than what you do, but is why do you do what you do? If you pretend that whatever your sabotage is, there's a part of you that has a damn good reason why it acts out the self-destruction. I mean, we sometimes make up this story like, oh, I'm doing this thing and it doesn't serve me well. Well, I think we're intelligent people. We wouldn't be self-destructing if it didn't serve us in some way. By serve us, meaning it kind of like compensates. So what do you do? And then get curious. Why do I do this? And question number three is, how does part of me benefit by doing this? So, okay, I might say like I've been in a relationship that's just, we're always fighting and it's just obvious. This relationship died 3 years ago. Okay, so that's my self-sabotage, reoccurring patterns of relationship dysfunction. Why do I do this? Is this replicating a sense of familiarity from my childhood? Do I feel like I'm just perpetually not good enough for her? And then the third question, like how do I benefit from that? Do I find a sense of comfort in the discomfort of the incessant conflict, for example? So for me, a curious mindset is very important to get to the story under the story of our self-sabotage, get beyond the symptoms to kind of like the root in our heart of why we do what we do.
So I've looked at my own thing and certainly burning myself out is something that I've been a professional at for a long time. And that's one way to avoid like dealing with feelings is like, I have to work more. Like just one more email, I'll be fine. And then you collapse and then you rinse and repeat. And oftentimes, at least when I was really motivated in my 20s, it was more like fear of failure than anything else. But like I made $6 million when I was 26. Like that's a pretty good motivation.
Yeah.
If you equate failure with death instead of learning, you're going to go down that path. So I certainly would do that. And I came across a tool called the Enneagram. Have you ever looked at that?
Yes, I have. I don't know much about it. I've got a book on it. Haven't read it. And I've had other people do, but I'd love to hear how that's worked for you. I don't know much about it at all.
So I can tell you that I don't remember my Enneagram number. Which means, doesn't mean that
my intuition tells me you're a six.
Sure. I don't even remember what the numbers are. But when I read the book and did the test for the Enneagram, it was really insightful. It was the only kind of Myers-Briggs style scoring system that had like the psycho-spiritual component. But what it said is it said, here's how you manifest when you're doing things in the good place for you. Mm-hmm. And here's how you can tell that you're starting to, like, here's your self-sabotage patterns. And it actually would tell you step one, step two, step three, step four with shocking precision.
Oh, is that right?
So it's Enneagram for people who are listening. And I'm not trained in the thing. I read the book. I did a workshop with it a long, long time ago. And I just remember thinking, this is like the most complete. So if you're looking for self-sabotage, like, why do I do that? I can tell you, self-sabotage is a major issue for almost everyone, and it's going to be invisible, because what you'll do is you'll say, I'm doing it for a reason, which is a story that you made up, mm-hmm. Or you'll say it's someone else's fault, like they're making me do it. And so that's that inner awareness thing, which can only be, only really be released by reading How to Be Ultra Spiritual by J.P. Sears. I worked that plug-in seamlessly for you, didn't I?
Yeah, it was graceful. I think you redefined grace. In fact, I think I can hear classical music playing right now, even though it's not playing.
You know we're going to cut some in, so it's actually playing later.
Oh, very cool.
So who's the fool here, huh?
And please cut this part out where we're talking about we're going to cut it in, just so people...
It's called the third wall. We're not supposed to violate the third wall, but violating third walls is part of your kitsch, isn't it?
I don't know what it means, but the answer is definitely yes.
I think they call it might be the fourth wall. I get my numbers wrong, but there's some sort of wall between you guys like watching and listening, and I'm not really a TV guy, but I heard someone say it once, and it made me feel smart.
Then it's true if it made you feel smart.
Your weird dry humor is rubbing off on me, and it makes me feel dirty.
Oh, you're welcome. I appreciate that compliment. It's the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me.
Speaking of compliments, I do have a copy of your book, pre-release copy of the book. Mm. And I turned over the book to the back of the book because what I found is that if you look at the cool picture on the front with the flower in your hair and you look at the back of the book, you can actually say that you've read the entire book because you just pretend like you didn't have to open it. I'm kidding. I've actually read the book. And the back of it, though, had an interesting quote from a guy I've heard of. Loaded with laugh-out-loud humor, an intelligent exploration of the spiritual delusions many fall prey to. Enjoy JP's perceptive underlying insights while you laugh beyond all understanding. From Tony Robbins. That's pretty high praise. Like, Tony gets asked to say stuff about books like every 5 seconds of his life, I imagine.
I'm sure.
And doesn't really respond to those emails, I would also imagine.
Yeah.
I've never asked him to say anything about mine, but he once said something nice about Brain Octane. I was like, holy shit, Tony, that's amazing. But you had some other people in here that I wanted to quote because I thought some of these were almost as impressive.
They're like, all high-vibe people, yeah.
Combines the wisdom of bearded Jesus with the playfulness of baby Jesus. And that was a quote from, it says here, the Holy Mother of God.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a powerful endorsement. It almost rivals Tony's endorsement, but that's powerful in and of itself.
Funnier than the law of karma, the universe. This is high praise for a book. It really is a cool perspective. Like it is a funny book, and the idea that you're working this stuff in where people can pay attention to their weaknesses, they can look at what's going on, but through the lens of humor, it's actually a hard achievement to do. And you pulled it off, which is cool.
Well, thank you, my friend. I appreciate that. To me, humor, it's a language. And I think it's a language that we tend to have our mind's defenses surrendered when we're talking about humor. Like if I start talking, you and I are talking in a series, we're going to get, a little bit resistant. And especially if you start sharing new perspectives with me, like we were talking about earlier, like, ooh, that's different. Let me resist that. But there's something about the energy of humor. There's like a non-threatening energy. So I find that the human psyche tends to be relatively less defended when we're talking in the language of humor. So if we embed deeper messages in humor, which from my biased perspective, I do my best to do that in my book and my videos, then it's like we can bring the messages into our psyche. They can penetrate deeper and we can consider them because we've been undefended. We haven't rejected them before we've even considered them, like we might do with new ideas, new perspectives that are essentially told to us through the language of seriousness. So I know humor is not the only language, but to me, it's a very powerful language, underused language.
And it maybe makes people feel safer about facing some of these. I remember when I was first getting into the personal development side of things. I'd done a little bit of like performance-oriented neurofeedback, but I hadn't done any EMDR. I hadn't done heart rate variability. And I was basically in this place where, like, yeah, I'm pretty angry most of the time, but like any other emotion, like there's no other emotion. Like, F all that, right? And I went and I did a lot of personal, just like personal exploration around those things. And it took, I wouldn't look at anything other than through a rational lens. And a lot of people who are actually suffering the most have learned that if you just make everything go through the slowest part of the brain, which is the thinking part, even though it takes a lot of energy to do that, then everything works. And then you just kind of ignore everything underneath that. And this is metabolically expensive. It will cost you, but it's an invisible cost, and it burns a lot of energy in a way that isn't making you stronger. It just wastes it. And it's energy that you really could use just to like watch Breaking Bad reruns over and over. It's just like free energy that's just sitting there. And for me, it was definitely anger. But behind anger, there's always fear. But I was really not open to hearing any of that crap.
Yeah.
But when you look at it through humor, all of the defensiveness goes away, because like, who can be defensive around like the right kind of humor anyway? So that's a cool way to maybe make people face things. And one of the people I'd first started working with said, oh, you need to read this book called, it was like Heal the Shame That Binds You.
Oh, by John Bradshaw. Love the book.
Famous book, right? And but I was like, I don't have any shame. Screw you guys. Toss the book to the side. Like, what kind of a weakling would have shame? Like,
exactly.
I got nothing to be ashamed of. You know how successful I am, right?
Shame is for small children, not real men.
Exactly.
Damn it.
Totally. And I remember that. And in fact, I still never read that damn book. No, I'm kidding. But it was one of those things where that wasn't accessible to me.
Yeah.
Because I was very cognitive. And it's not that you stop thinking for yourself. I got to the point, and I'm still at that point, where I have an engineering brain, you know, studied a subset of artificial intelligence and computer science and all that. There's a completely rational part of the world and part of my inner world, and there's also a completely irrational part of it.
Yeah.
And the inner conflict that comes from those, I don't have it anymore. Because I'm like, look, there's these stupid bacteria, this operating system level of the body that's irrational. Like, it's an animal. It doesn't follow logic. It doesn't have context. And at the same time, there's a rational side of me, which I like to identify with more. But the fact of the matter is there may be a complete gap between those things, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right? So I can do things that make my animal happy that make no sense. Yes, I'll sit in a drumming circle. Look, what? There's no like double-blind studies and rational reason that you should do almost all the things that you like to do.
Yeah.
So that was my perspective on just on maybe why humor works, because it can let you get past that resistance to looking at yourself.
Yeah, and part of what I heard you say is humor can be a bridge. It bridges it can be a massive canyon. The 18 inches between our head and our heart can sometimes be just like 10,000 miles of distance, essentially. So I heard you say, like, humor can be that bridge. And something, my delusional perspective about you is you're a very intelligent guy. Maybe that's not so delusional. I think you could crush Forrest Gump in an IQ competition.
I'd work hard.
And I think for a lot of like high cognitive functioning people, there might be a couple things that happens. One, I just wonder, like, did you develop your high caliber cognitive function essentially as a compensation to escape the pain in your heart? And or maybe that was just there and it was going to be there all along, but it becomes an easy escape mechanism. And to me, so I just get curious about that. I don't know if any of it's true, but to me, the most beautiful thing is you have taken painstaking efforts to bridge that gap. I mean, I would imagine you could just be in your head all day. Life would seem pretty good, but there's something that's called you to the adventure of your heart, and you've bridged the gap. It's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. I don't know how other people feel if they live all in their head, but I think that there's usually a kind of a background screaming going on that you're like living in your head to avoid.
Yeah.
That you'll eventually be called to pay attention to. Otherwise, you'll sort of be miserable.
Yeah. And on that note about how other people might feel who live in their head, to me, one of the potential feelings, because I've spent so much time in my head in my life, the worst feeling is the feeling of not feeling feelings, numbness. To me, it's the most tormenting sensation. So when we're walking around numb, it's like we see life, we know life is going on, but we're not experiencing life. I think our emotions are inside of us for a reason, to give us the three-dimensional experience of life rather than just knowing about life.
Well, numbness is a perception, unless you actually have a severed nerve. So what's going on is the mitochondria that sense the world around us on a microsecond by microsecond basis, they're still taking all that in, right? And then they communicate it at the cell level, and some of those cells communicate it at the nerve level, and then like all this environmental stuff changes in the body, and you're capable of sensing all those. So what the numbness is actually a full-on disconnect. So your sensation of numbness is that either you intentionally cut off, or you decided on some subconscious level that is noise, not signal, and that you're just not going to listen to it. But
so it's there, you're just not paying attention.
Yeah. And people who are more like on the autism ADD side of things, the signal to noise ratio isn't where you want it to be. So they already have a hard time figuring out what the signal is from their nervous system versus just, random whatevers. Yeah. And so they're like, just toss all that crap. Like, it's too much work. I don't want to deal with it. Mm. And the idea is, if something feels like too much work, well, what if you had like something that was capable of putting out a lot more power? Then it wouldn't feel like too much work. And that's why like Headstrong, the whole thing of hacking your mitochondria is like, what if they just made more energy? Then what felt like a lot of work wouldn't be a lot of work. It's just the fundamental laziness. But it applies even to something like being aware of where your numbness comes from. Mm. See, I didn't think we'd go quite this deep. This is kind of cool. I want to know though. So you've got 100 million YouTube views. You have your ultra spiritual book. You have your freaking hilarious t-shirts, spiritual as hell and all those things. So you're a creative guy, and I've seen you on stage and a couple different times. So there's a creative process, and I've had a chance. I haven't done it on film before or on Bulletproof Radio, but I've asked like Stephen Jenkins from Third Eye Blind, like, what do you do to prepare for a concert before you go on stage? So he promised he'd come on one of these days and talk about that. So I'll get that on air at some point. But I like to know, like, what do like really successful performers do in order to make your material? So what's your process to get into JP Sears with a flower in your hair?
Yeah, I think there's a few different phases of the creative process. Like, I would say like the most raw of the creative process is coming up with the video ideas and then developing a script or writing the book.
But how do you come up with an idea? Like, the creative process is hard.
So that, like, bringing in the raw materials, that process is seemingly random. Like, the creativity comes to me when I'm not trying to be creative.
Oh.
So, like, if I'm just, like, airplanes for me are a big source of creativity, it's a time when a lot of creativity happens. And I don't know why. It might have something to do with, like, I'm somewhat uncomfortable. But just ideas flood to me when I'm on airplanes.
You want to know why?
Yeah, let's hear it.
So, at least in the model that I use at 40 Years of Zen and in my own life, the fount of creation is theta state. That's where you go for dreaming. Mm. So intuition and creativity sit there. And most of the time when you have a dream, you don't remember it.
Right.
So there's actually like software that I use called Neuraminer that trains you to remember what happens in that state.
Hmm.
But when you go on an airplane, you've got relatively poor quality lighting, but you've also got white noise.
Right.
Like all that stuff going on, and you are relatively uncomfortable. You're so uncomfortable that you can't go to sleep very easily.
Right.
So what's happening is you've got white noise and essentially a background annoyingness that helps your body drop into a theta state, and you're uncomfortable enough that you don't fall asleep where you won't get all the value from it. So it pops you into that mode.
Fascinating. So, yay. And luckily, I'm on airplanes enough that I get to take advantage of that.
Okay.
And then, so that's where the raw materials come from. And then the next part of my creative process is like taking those, like the big idea and filling in the microcosm, if you will, of that idea. And for me, I dedicate the first 1 hour of my day after my morning routine, and I'm woken up at the first hour of my workday is developed or devoted to writing. So scripting.
Like the artist's way, kind of just like getting out of your head writing or?
Well, no, like it would be like making a video script, writing the book, but something that I'm really applying my creativity to, a project that's got material to it.
So I find it kind of irritating. Like Naveen Jain, when he was on, who, by the way, Naveen Jain is founder of InfoSpace and the guy who's behind Moon Express and the new company called Viome. And he just invested in Bulletproof this week, which is
right
cool.
On.
So, well, this week when we're recording, but anyway, so now I have like this cool billionaire investor guy on board, which is awesome. Joined our advisory board. So Naveen, when I interviewed him, I'm like, what are your morning habits? And he goes, why the heck would you want to know my morning habits? Like something, and I'm misquoting him, but he's like, only a loser would want to follow someone else's morning habits. You know why people do the habits. Like it's the thinking that matters.
Yeah.
Right. So I kind of want to ask you about your morning habits, but I also don't want people to like think, I'll be just like J.P. Sears if I just follow his habits, because sure. Your habits work for you, but your habits might not work for them.
Yeah.
That said, what are your habits? No. But so you said your first hour, but you don't like wake up in bed and write, do you?
No, no, I don't. So first thing I do is I take a cold shower. That rule, so stimulating.
Hot, then cold or just cold?
Just cold.
Wow.
And then, yeah, hardcore.
Viking.
Yeah, brother. And then from there, I do some gratitude journaling. So I write down, actually, this is a routine, a dimension of the routine I got from Tony Robbins. Three things I'm grateful for, but to bring it just from my head and integrate it to my heart, feel the feelings
the
of gratitude.
The sensation of gratitude,
for sure.
Well said.
And then I write down three creative projects that I'm working on so to just energize what's important to me creatively. Then I take a 30-minute walk. Come back and make Bulletproof coffee. I'm not just saying that because I'm talking to Dave. I've been on Bulletproof coffee.
That's awesome. It
brings me, getting into ketosis or close to it. I don't measure my blood, but
you don't need to. If you use brain octane, you're getting some ketones just by definition.
Yeah, so I use a crap load of brain octane, grass-fed butter, like I'm telling you what's in Bulletproof coffee. Do you know about Bulletproof coffee? So I do find it makes a noticeable difference for my mental sharpness, my brain energy, and my physical energy. Like typically, then I'm not eating like my first solid food until 1 p.m. at the earliest, sometimes 2. Then I take my coffee and I start my creative writing, whatever the 1 hour of creativity is.
So. Do you take any other smart drugs?
No.
And I'll give you some before you go. Okay. There's some that can help.
I mean, is crystal meth a smart drug?
No, it's just a stimulant. We have real smart drugs.
But no other smart drugs.
If you're open to it, I will give you some. I don't mean like I make nootropics that are not drugs, some of the Bulletproof stuff, but I mean like an actual pharmaceutical smart drug sort of thing that it is legal to give you because they're over-the-counter stuff.
Interesting. So those kind of scare me.
Yeah.
And I'm not educated on them, but I'm curious, like what would be the one you're thinking of?
Aniracetam. So the ones in the racetam family are exceedingly safe and they increase memory IO, at least that one does. And they don't have addictive things at all. They're not stimulants. The biggest side effect, they amplify caffeine a little bit. And for some of them, they reduce acetylcholine, the neurotransmitter. Like they use more choline because your brain works faster. But they're essentially neuroprotective. Like your chances of living longer when you take them are higher. So I've been on this stuff almost every day for nearly 20 years now.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and there's different varieties of that family. But I'll if you want to try some, I'll give you some, and I'd just say take it with your Bulletproof in the morning. When you want to really create something amazing, and just see what happens. But your risk is relatively low on these, and these are things anyone can order online. I don't sell any of them, and I can't tell you where the safest place to buy them is because there's always
probably Tijuana, Mexico is the safest place to buy anything.
I usually get a smoothie made out of them there. They just put a few Viagra, a few aniracetams, blend it right up with some cactus.
Yes. You can. Yeah, fascinating. I'd love to learn more about that.
All right, I'll get you some. Some of the most creative people I know, they do get the boost from having exogenous ketones like brain octane and all that. But nicotine can help too, even if you're not a smoker. And I wrote a few blog posts about how to use nicotine as a smart drug. And when you think about it, like almost every great work of literary fiction was written with copious amounts of coffee, nicotine, and sometimes alcohol, which is not a performance enhancer.
Yeah,
but there is something about that. So I'm a huge fan of microdosing nicotine, and I've never smoked. Smoking is bad for you. I would never smoke. Sure. But that one compound is better studied than caffeine. Like if I was to pick the most studied smart drug on the planet, it's nicotine. And maybe I'd pick modafinil, which I took for like 8 years, and also will blow your writing away. But it's a bigger gun. Like that for you, that's probably too big.
Well, you saying I can't handle it, Dave?
I'm just saying you don't want to handle it.
Okay. Thank you. I feel better about myself now.
I can't imagine like that calm, like the kind of calm, centered voice on modafinil and some caffeine. You'd be like, it'd be more Beavis and Butthead and just less JP.
I'm not sure
that'd be the right vibe for you.
Yeah, if it changes my character, my personality. Like, you are someone different.
So, yeah. The one thing that a lot of people told me about modafinil, not nicotine, is, and something I felt as well, your mind works so fast that it's irritating because people are talking so slow.
Is that
like,
right?
Like you know what they're going to say. If they could just finish saying it, then you could go on to what's next. And you actually have to manage that. It can be, especially the first couple of weeks, it can be almost like a sense of rage.
Is that right?
Because why is everyone around me so goddamn slow? And it's not like I took Adderall for about a month. I had a prescription for it a long time ago just to try it. It was a horrible drug for me. And I was taking like small doses and like, please don't touch me. It was not good. But it's not ampy like that, but it's just like everything is fast. And at least you're fast, but everything else is slow. And it's not a good feeling until you just get used to running at a high speed.
Yeah.
I was there when I explained how this worked to a guy doing a really long detailed proposal for the Dalai Lama, another guy who's written a very successful book about the global brain. In fact, he was on the show. I think he talked about this. I hope he did. Steve Almohundro. Sorry, Steve. I think you did talk about that in your blog. Steve's like a friend and an AI researcher. And another person who's a clinical hypnotherapist. And each of them had 100 milligrams of modafinil for the first time. I just told them like how the stuff worked, and they had their own doctor prescriptions and all that kind of stuff. And then they all came back a week later, and like, I just took that one dose. And the Dalai Lama guy's like, I finished the proposal I've been working on for weeks and weeks. I finished it all at once, and it's the best writing I've ever done, and they accepted my proposal. And Steve's like, 2 chapters of my book.
That's awesome.
So for creative stuff, I haven't taken the stuff in about 4 years because I measured my brain after 8 years of being on it. My brain runs at that speed without it, as long as I follow the Bulletproof diet. Like if I go out and eat inflammatory foods, I'm like back to my slow normal self. But on university grade levels, you can't do that. So if you're like writing your opus, I'd say go for the racetams, add in some modafinil, a little spray of nicotine and a double bulletproof coffee, but just don't go on stage the next day because you won't be yourself.
I might develop a new character.
angry JP.
But that's fascinating. So that guy got all hopped up on all that, and then he did a marriage proposal to the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama said yes. Is that the moral of the story that I gathered?
It's the moral of the story.
I'm a good listener.
After that, he was one with everything. That was pretty good. You got to give me credit for that.
Did you hear this? I digress. Do you hear the joke about the Dalai Lama ordering a hot dog?
I already know the punchline.
Yeah, but it's just going to be a terrible joke. I won't even say it. Everybody, you've probably heard it. If you haven't, it's not really worth listening to. Certainly by Dave and JP.
All right. So I interrupted you by suggesting an upgrade to your Bulletproof coffee there, which was terribly rude as the inquisitive questioner here.
I'm offended.
I'm just trying to add some value to your otherwise valueless work. And see, that kind of thing, it doesn't feel good to say that. I know you don't take that seriously, but even so, I don't like to say unkind things. Like when I say that, I felt that.
But and I love that you felt how it felt to you. Yeah. Was it sarcasm? Yes. Did it hurt me? No. But it hurt you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so awesome you could feel that. Be like, oh, coming from that angle, I don't want to do that again.
Yeah, but it was still kind of funny.
Yeah. I think the funniest jokes are the ones where you have to tell other people that they're funny.
I kind of messed with the one eyebrow raise, and you kind of got that pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. If you're watching this on YouTube, that was funny because we were having a little eyebrow war there. But as it was on your commute, you're like, these guys are kind of weird. All right. So we talked about your morning. You do the Tony Robbins inspired gratitude journaling. Yeah. You use Bulletproof. You don't eat till 2, which is very similar to my morning, although I don't do the gratitude stuff in the morning. I have young children, so my gratitude practice involves put on your shoes, put on your shoes, put on your shoes, get in the car, and you just repeat everything 5 or 6 times, and eventually it happens, and then you're grateful that it happens.
Yeah, it's like a mantra that actually works.
And then I come back and I like do biohacking stuff, so I'll do the gratitude stuff in the evening. Okay, so you do that, and you structure your writing, so the first hour is essentially new scripts, like your most powerful writing is the first hour, and then you go into work mode after that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So work mode, I mean, my writing is part of my work, but I don't even like to call it work. That's why I call it the creative time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, then I'll go into work. So it might be interviews that are scheduled, clients, meetings, filming videos.
Okay, cool. When you're going to be either shooting a video or going live on stage,
yeah,
what do you do to get in the zone for that?
So very different. So with a video, like calm down, just find my center, breathing like meditation, like I just need calm and slowness. But when I'm going on stage in front of an audience, it's just the opposite. Like I want to get hyped up, and like I don't go on stage yelling and screaming.
You don't seem hyped up in front of an audience. You're a character.
But I like to just really raise my energy, even though I don't project my voice loud and move around with a lot of dynamic motion, but I just love to enter the stage being kind of like as high frequency as I can.
Okay.
And also in a part of my go on stage practice is remind myself I am here to give. This isn't about me. I find when I try to make this about me, I want this to go good so everybody's pleased so I feel better about myself. That's when like I start to feel a little anxiety, a little nervous. Like it just takes me off my center. But when I remind myself, I'm here to give. This is for the audience. It just puts me in a much better state, similar to like what gratitude journaling mm-hmm. would be. So it puts me in a giving frame of mind.
It's interesting. Being of service to others is one of the things that reliably gets some people into a flow state.
Mm.
Right? Some people have to be like in fear of death, falling down a mountain with a failing parachute or something to really get in the flow state. But for the rest of us who aren't going to get mortally wounded, it's a pretty reliable way to do it. So for you, just that mindset, same thing. I don't have any stress on stage because I'm like, I'm here to give.
Yeah.
But if I'm like, I'm here to take, I might have anxiety, but I don't know. That's just not what I do anymore.
Mm.
So I hear you there. So you get super hyped. You do some breathing before you go on stage. And then you just go on and you deliver. Okay.
Yeah.
How conscious are you while you're delivering? Are you like doing a memorized thing? Are you thinking about everything you watch in the audience? Like, what do you do with your mind?
Yeah. So to give you a couple answers, okay. If I'm going on stage to do comedy, I mean, typically my stage time, I'm either doing comedy or I'm giving a sincere discussion from my heart. When I'm doing comedy, much like the nature of a lot of stand-up comedy, I do have it scripted. Like I've got my quote unquote routine. But I like to be so solid on that it's something to launch off of. So I love engaging with the audience, just improvising, you know, when there's little interactions. To me, that's just, it's so beautiful. So being able to be present with people, essentially have the routine so ingrained in my nervous system that I don't have to think about it so I can be more present. And I just love that feel. And I think it gives a better product, if you will. And if I'm going on stage to deliver more of a sincere discussion of my heart, whether it's about authenticity, healing, growth, whatever it might be, I'll know the topic that I'm going to talk about. I'll probably know some key points or principles, but I like to be very unscripted. I like to be very spontaneous and get into the flow state, connecting with the audience so it can be a true communication. Not just a monologue. Even if I'm the only one talking, a communication to me is different than a monologue. It's like I'm feeling, I'm receiving, I'm looking at the body language and sounding airy-fairy, but feeling the energy of the audience.
There's any effective presenter and any effective teacher in a live setting has a sense of the feedback from the room. And it's probably electromagnetic. Because we know that your heart rate variability will change in response to those around you, and theirs will change in response to yours. And I became a more effective speaker when I learned to train my heart rate variability. So I have a higher amplitude heart rate variability, and it's called coherent, so it's non-chaotic. So people are like, I don't know why, but like it feels calmer, and so the room will resonate with you if you do it right. And I think you have to be in a flow state to do that as well.
Very cool.
And then when you're aware of that, if you say something that takes you out of the zone, it's because it probably took the audience out of the zone, and you're like kind of at one with them in some sense. Is that a description of what you're doing? I mean, you may not be doing heart rate variability exercises, but does that sound the same?
Yeah, 100%. Okay. Absolutely. It's just like if you're dancing, you're going to pay attention to your dance partner, and the dance will go well. It'll be enjoyable. It'll be graceful. It'll be a beautiful artistic expression if you're paying attention to your dance partner. And to me, being on stage, you have a dance partner. It's not a one-person thing. It's a collective consciousness of everybody that's in there. So, man, I think half the talk is receiving what the dance partner's giving you.
Very well said. Wow, I've never thought about dancing with my audience, but maybe that's because your audience is more attractive than mine.
I actually have a very attractive audience. Thank you guys very much.
That's
so are you, Dave, let's get to the bottom of this. Are you saying your audience is ugly? Are you saying fans of Bulletproof Radio are unattractive?
I was implying that, but I didn't actually say it. But it was an alternative fact, so it was okay.
You love Donald Trump. Conversation's over.
Oh, man. Now you've polarized everyone. The problem is I don't know which poll I'm on. I'm very confused now.
Yeah.
I'm going to do some self-sabotage right now.
Dave loves you guys. He does. Promise.
On that note, I can't think of a better way to end the show. You guys should check out How to Be Ultra Spiritual, JP's new book. And no, actually, JP didn't like pay me or twist my arm to say anything about his book. I'm actually just saying things because I always bring authors on who write good stuff, because I'm assuming if you're willing to spend an hour of your time listening to Bulletproof Radio that you probably care about what's in your head. So I will suggest things you might have put in your head. This is a good read, and it's funny. And hey, Tony Robbins agrees. So, I mean, who's going to argue with Tony Robbins? He's like 99 feet tall or something. He's taller than me. You don't argue with that guy. He'll like palm your face.
Thank you for the beautiful words about the book, Brian. I so appreciate you.
You're welcome. I appreciate you coming up to the labs and hanging out for a day. And we've cryotherapied you and done all sorts of other crazy stuff for you.
Yeah. I had one of the, a hardcore workout and 4 minutes? Oh, that is amazing.
I noticed you were looking a little bit less weak than normal.
Oh, Dave, I didn't even know that you would notice. Oh, I'm getting tired. I mean, by the way, you're looking less weak than normal, too. You've got some girth on your arms, brother.
I've been doing SARMs, Selective SARMs. Androgen Receptor Modifiers. I wrote a post about it. And I tried a stack of them a while back. It didn't see that much. So I added another one. And I put on 19 pounds of muscle in a month.
Wow.
I did 4 workouts. So, I mean, that was...
Only 4 workouts over the course of a month?
It was stupid. Yes. I wasn't trying to put on 19 pounds of muscle. Like, if you guys ever see me in person, like, I'm not a small dude.
Sure.
I'm 6'4", and I'm already imposing enough. New York Times said I was almost muscular. I'm like, that's what makes you live a long time, is when you're almost muscular. Like, enough muscle mass, but not enough to, like, stress the heart. And, like, my shirt barely fits.
Yeah.
And I had to, like, buy a new suit. And I'm like, this sucks. Like, I don't want to be hulking out of my clothes. But it was nice because I lost some fat at the same time. But I cannot claim it was just that exercise. I did 1 electrical stem and 3 of the computerized resistance training ones that you just did downstairs. And a couple of yoga classes in there too. It was like, whoosh. So I'm going to be doing another round of those at some point just for fun. I don't want to get any beefier than this.
Yeah, watch it. And I digress, yet the last thing I'll say, one of the effective workout routines that I'm doing is I take my shirt size and then I wear a shirt 2 sizes smaller than that. I can't say enough for how much bigger that makes my muscles look.
It is working for me right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I washed the shirt in hot water and I gained like 5 pounds of muscle.
Yeah. So wearing your wife's shirts, I think, is working so well for you.
Yeah. The back straps are particularly attractive, I think.
I think they're. Thank you for having me, Andy. This has been a treat.
It's been great fun, JP. And I look forward to hanging out next time we get a chance to hang out. And hopefully you'll be at the next Bulletproof Conference. We'll see if we can get your travel to line up.
I'd love to.
Before we sign off, how to be ultra spiritual, where do people go to get this? Are you doing some sort of a book launch? You think we didn't plan any of this.
You can really get it anywhere books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can also go to howtobeultraspiritual.com, but really anywhere you want to get it online is the best place.
All right. Have an awesome day. And since you're listening and all that, if you liked this episode, which I got to say, we went places that I don't normally go in these episodes, a lot of personal development stuff from someone who's both trained in personal development and comedy, which is cool. Go to iTunes, take 5 seconds to express some gratitude and just leave a little 5-star review because it really helps people know that this is a good podcast and that it's worthy of their time. And then share it with a friend. Say, hey, you should subscribe to this. That's one of the biggest things you could do to say thanks to an author is you buy a copy of their book or you tell someone else about them. And that's what lets good ideas spread. So thanks for doing that. Before we sign off, I've got to ask you the Bulletproof question.
Mm.
The thing is, you've heard enough episodes of Bulletproof Radio. You already know the question, don't you?
I'm going to pretend like I don't know.
Oh, awesome. So fake sincerity. That's so cool.
I like it. Actually, I don't know. I've listened. All right. I haven't been taking enough brain octane.
So you haven't actually ever heard the show before. Is that what I'm hearing?
So you're saying you do have a podcast.
Lovely.
I thought all this equipment was just for show.
Here's the question. If someone came to you tomorrow mm-hmm. and said, I want to perform better at everything I do.
Yeah.
What are the 3 most important pieces of advice you have for me? What would you tell them?
Great. So make yourself intentionally uncomfortable every damn day, just like we mentioned. Meditate. And then practice the living heck out of whatever it is you do. I am into hacking the system. And I also am a fan of kind of like the old cliche 10,000 hour rule to mastery. Man, I think that deserves respect. So practice your craft.
Love it. Thanks, JP.
You're welcome, brother.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.